Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to start the program today talking about a place in the world that I think we have very profound interests in, and we certainly try to do our best to cover here at Securing America, often with the help of a great friend and valued colleague of many, many years. Her name is Shoshana Bryan. She is the director of policy at the Jewish Policy Center and a very frequent contributor there and elsewhere to, well, our understanding of what is transpiring in the Middle East writ large, but also in the state of Israel and what it all means for us. And so we're always pleased to be able to catch up with her to take stock of all of that. Shoshana Bryan, welcome back once again. It's great to have you with us, ma'am.
Thank you, Frank. Nice to be here.
I'd like to start by asking you, you wrote about President Isaac Herzog's speech to the Congress of the United States before it happened. You gave him some very good advice as to what he should say. How did you think it came out?
I think it was great. He did exactly what he came here to do. Remember, their president in Israel is not like ours. He is outside the government. So he represents the state of Israel. What I found most interesting was the congressional response to him. First of all, nobody missed the squad. Nobody missed them at all. But where they applauded was very important.
But they were absent, I think.
They were absent. There were five or nine or whatever they were not missed. But where the applause came was very important. Most important, in my opinion, was on Iran. And he made it very clear how Israel feels about Iran and how he thinks the United States should approach Iran. And they applauded him. And I think President Biden needs to look at that and say to himself, how much support will I have? I know we're going to talk about this, you know, in more depth. But from Herzog's point of view, the two points he needed to make, one was about Iran, and that Israel has its own plans and will protect itself. And the other was about Palestinians and what is and what is not possible. So in those cases, he got there.
I want to come back to both of those topics in our second block. So hold the thought. Let's turn to another pressing question, which is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who, as you say, does run the government of Israel, not the president, seemingly out of harm's way in terms of apparent heart condition, as best you can tell?
As best I can tell. And they haven't given us a whole lot to go on. Nearly as I can tell, he had a pacemaker implanted. And that would not, as most Americans know, lots of us have pacemakers, that would not be a tremendous impediment to the running of the government. It doesn't appear to be more than that.
It was described as an emergency treatment, and that, of course, heightens concerns. But
yes, because
if it fixed the problem, then he's good to go.
He had a breathing issue in a public place. I mean, there was an issue, and now they seem to have fixed the issue.
Good. Well, praise God. They fixed that issue. Another fix that seems to be still in the offing is to try to remove him from office, which is tied up with this very, I think, important matter of judicial reform. You've made it very clear that you think that is an internal Israeli affair, and indeed it is. And it's shocking that our government continues to meddle in it, as it seems to be doing. And maybe you could tie in your response the general question of what on earth is our government doing vis-a-vis the Netanyahu government to seemingly undermine it at every turn. But there is, as I understand it now, the plan to finish the consideration of this judicial reform package with the so-called third reading in the Knesset sometime this week. As best you can tell, does that seem to be on track? And what are we to make of the intensifying efforts of the left to try to disrupt things, including bring down the government if it can?
This is all about bringing down the government. This is really not about judicial reform as a legal matter in the state of Israel. The judicial reform itself simply undoes some things that were done in the middle of the 90s. Some people thought it went too far back in the 90s, but that's the government they had. That's what they did. There are people who want to undo it. There are also people who want to undo the government. And that is a bigger issue. They tend to be left of center, Ashkenazi background, people that are called the old elite of Israel. And they haven't come to terms yet with the fact that the country has shifted demographically and shifted politically to those Israelis whose backgrounds are in Arab countries and the Middle East.
So-called Sephardim. Mm-hmm.
Sephardim, Mizrahim, you know, whatever they call, they're different names for different groups. But those people who came from the region, and they tend to be much more conservative. So what you see is the old Zionists, the old left, losing power, and they don't want to. And since they lost it at the ballot box, they're doing this. I would point out to you, however, that Saturday night in Israel, 200,000 Israelis came out for demonstrations in favor of judicial reform. And you will not read that in the New York Times. The majority of the population in Israel, according to the polls, favors judicial reform. And 200,000 Israelis went out to tell you that. So it's really important to understand them.
200,000
in a country,
in a population
less than 10
that
million.
Size, yes. Is a tremendous turnout. And they've, yes, had this kind of outpouring of support, I think, in the past few, yes, months as well. Shoshana, I'm of the view that, you know, this is of paramount importance both to democracy in Israel, but also for our interests in the government there as well. And I guess I would just ask you, to the extent that the left is now determined to try to topple Benjamin Netanyahu's government, what are the prospects for them succeeding at doing that, given that the majority of the population does not support them?
If there is a coup in Israel, if they march the prime minister out of his office, that will be a disaster for Israel. And I don't think anybody wants to do that. I don't think the left wants to do it either. I think they want to find a way to vote him out, because all of the things that you've seen in Israel to date have stayed within the realm of what's legal and what's appropriate for a democratic country. And I don't think anybody wants the military to go rushing into parliament and throw him out. But it's unlikely, given the makeup of the parliament right now, it's unlikely that they're going to vote him out. So I see more stalemate. I don't see, barring some strange thing that I don't expect the government to be overthrown. I know that the left will keep trying to get votes to vote him out of office.
Well, this is the best case scenario, I guess, is they don't succeed or even stalemate. But there has been talk, as you know, about not only bringing down the government, but civil war, and
there
even the
talk.
Assassination of, you know, members of the cabinet, including the prime minister. And it's not just coming from, you know, the Antifa equivalents in Israel. It seems as though it's been coming, to some extent, at least, from some eminent figures in the left, former prime ministers, former chiefs of staff of the military, right, and the like. And that's, I guess, what's so shocking, is that it seems as though this has reached a point where some things that you would think are out of bound, and that certainly the majority of the left's, you know, electorate wouldn't want either. And yet this is what we've been hearing from some of their putative leaders, no?
Yes, you have. And some of these guys have been doing it for a couple of years. If you think that this arose overnight with the election of Netanyahu, and Netanyahu says we need to do judicial reform, and these guys jumped up. No, they have been stoking this fire for a couple of years. And I know you're too polite to give the name, but Ehud Barak, former prime minister of Israel, who really doesn't like the current prime minister of Israel, really doesn't like him, has been organizing this sort of thing for a long time. And here's where...
Hold the thought, Mish. We have to take a very short break. I want to hear all about it. And I'm not too polite to say Ehud Barak. I just hadn't gotten around to it yet. But
okay,
we will talk about Ehud Barak on the other side of this very short message. Stay tuned for more with Shoshana Bryan right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Israel is in turmoil, thanks in part to a former chief of staff of its military who has recently been revealed to have plotted the overthrow of Israel's government since 2020. That's long before last year's election of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu with a popular mandate to reform his nation's judiciary, a version of which was approved by Parliament today. The seditious machinations of retired general and former Prime Minister Ehud Barak should be a warning for the U.S. Senate. It is poised to confirm a highly political general, C.Q. Brown, as the next chairman of America's Joint Chiefs of Staff. Alan West has warned that in that role, he would be, quote, Al Sharpton with 4 stars, unquote. Think a U.S. general who champions critical race theory's hatred of whites and America's systemic racism, running our military won't be a problem? Think again. RejectGeneralBrown.org. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we're visiting with the Director of Policy of the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Her name is Shoshana Bryan, a very dear friend, as well as a very, very highly regarded observer and analyst of the Middle East in general and Israel and its importance to us in particular. Talk to us a little bit about what is animating this former Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, to, have been seeking for some time, as you say, a kind of, anti-democratic outcome with respect to the government of Israel.
So it's funny you should mention it as anti-democratic. What animates him is what animates the far left. Okay, they want to get rid of these people. They don't want the old order to be upset. But what allows them to be animated is that they're funded. Okay, and among the funders of this, because you can't do anything without funding, all those people who have been schlepping up and down the streets, right? They're supposed to be at work. Who's paying them?
Stopping traffic, among other things.
Who's paying them? We are. We, the United States of America, have a hand in this. Not all of it. We are not funding it, and we're not funding it directly. But we fund a number of what are called civil society organizations, and they are nonprofits that are supposed to be helping countries be more democratic or to deepen their democratic roots. Now, I would say that one country that doesn't need a single nickel in civil society building money is the state of Israel. We also give a lot of civil society money to the Palestinians, and we could talk about what they do with it. But when you have this money coming in from outside factors, and no one knows where it came from, and no one knows where it's going, you can bet.
Or even the magnitude of it coming from the United States.
I mean, Congress needs to look at this. This is our money in some cases, and we need to be aware of that.
Big time. Let's pivot to the Palestinians. The New York Times has made the point, apparently, as you noted in your recent piece at the Jewish Policy Center, that the jig is up, basically. There's not going to be a Palestinian state. I've long believed that there is a Palestinian state. It's called Jordan. There doesn't need to be yet another one. Where are we in the acquiescence to that idea on the part of the Palestinians? And what is our own government doing to encourage them not to acquiesce to it?
Okay. 85% of the Israeli public, including the prior prime minister, Yair Lapid, have said whether or not there is going to be a Palestinian state, there's not going to be one now. And there's not going to be one now because the Palestinians are engaged in two things. One is incitement to violence, which has been very successful. They have incited a lot of young people to a lot of violence. And the other is the concept that they can erase Israel. So as long as the Palestinians... Well,
it's not a concept, it's a fixation, is it not?
Yes, a fixation, a concept.
Charter of the Palestinian Authority unchanged and all that?
But this is the part we haven't understood as the United States. We keep pushing, and the president in particular keeps pushing, something called a two-state solution, meaning a Palestinian state and a Jewish state, Israel plus Palestine. No. And no, because the Palestinians do not agree to two states. That's one of their problems. The other of the problems is that they are in the middle of a civil war, the Palestinians. Forget Israel. Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad on the one side and the Palestinian Authority on the other side are engaged in a shooting war, a real, honest to God, civil war with guns. So
I thought they were shooting at Israelis, but you're saying they're shooting at each other as well?
Well, as well. I mean, there's lots of guns and lots of people to shoot them. But if you remember the way Gaza came under the control of Hamas in 2006-7 was a civil war. They went to the Palestinian Authority government offices and threw them out. They threw them off the rooftops. They intend the same in the West Bank. Israel does not want to go that route because that puts Iran in the West Bank and they don't want that. So they've been actually trying to reduce the Hamas PIJ presence in the West Bank. The operation in Jenin was not about the Palestinian Authority. It was about Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad.
Really? I didn't see that in the New York Times either.
How do you think the New York Times decided it's not happening now?
Yeah.
They're smarter than they write.
Mm. Yeah. The interesting thing there is that the Palestinian Authority nonetheless seems inevitably to be denouncing Israel for these attacks that are aimed at, if you're right,
and
it's kind of hard to believe that there is a dime's worth of difference between the Palestinians of Fatah and of Hamas.
Ultimately, there's no difference. What pushes the Palestinian Authority to the more violent side, it's violent to begin with, but pushes it to more overt violence, is hoping to win over some of the young people of the West Bank and say, look, you don't need to go to Hamas. You don't need to be religious. You don't need Iran in here. I'll take care of it. I will allow you to have violence against Israel. The Israeli government actually announced that it was going to save the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas. And Abbas said, no, don't bother. I don't need you. So he is not willing to deal with Israel, even under the extreme circumstance in which he finds himself. Israel, as Israel does, will take care of itself.
Yeah. Well, I hope they know what they're doing. In this case, it seems to me that they're all coming for Israel under whichever banner they fly.
They are.
Speaking of coming for Israel, of course, there is that other natty problem of Iran, as you mentioned earlier. And here again, we have the United States government actively aiding and abetting people who are hostile to us. And I'm trying to figure out what is up with that, and more to the point, where you think things stand with respect to it. And maybe in the process, you might tell us what you make of the guy who has been the prime mover behind all of this, Rob Malley's status.
Okay, so Iran is just like the Palestinians in the eyes of the Biden administration, which is the extension of the Obama administration. They believed, still believe, that negotiation will get you somewhere. That's what they believe. And yes, you have to give things, and maybe you give more things, and maybe you give ultimately things you shouldn't have given. But they are totally wedded to a negotiating process. Iran is not. Iran has cheated before 2015, after 2015, so whatever. They cheat because they have goals that are incompatible with our goals, and they are proceeding along the path to those goals. Now, who's watching them? We are, a little bit, but Israel is, a lot. And Israel has great capabilities in terms of watching Iran and understanding the position they're in vis-a-vis their nuclear program and other programs. So,
and I think, Shoshana, if I may, just throw back to what we talked about with the Herzog speech. I think he made it pretty clear in that speech that Israel was not going to accept Iran having the status of a so-called threshold state.
And did you notice people jumping up out of their seats and applauding him? And I'm not talking about just polite applause. This was something that Congress got it. Now, I don't know what they're going to do about it, but Congress gets it. There is no deal to be had. Democrats get it as well as Republicans. Not quite as well, but they get it.
Well, not quite as many, unfortunately.
Not quite as many.
And that's another story for another day, is the changes taking place within the Democratic caucus. Yeah. But with respect to Iran, are you of the view, Shoshana Bryan, your expert analysis, that there is now a deal between the United States and Iran, and billions more are flowing to the mullahs as a result, and that the threshold state is at best what we are reckoning with? At worst, it's actually got the bomb, or will at any moment?
I think there was a deal. I think it was very close. If it wasn't signed, it was very close. the movement of Malley, Rob Malley, out of his position as chief Iran envoy raises more questions than it answers. But one of the things that might emerge, might being emergent right here, is what he was doing. And I suspect that he was giving Iran things Iran shouldn't have. They shouldn't have American secrets and they shouldn't have Israeli secrets. And I wonder what he was doing and to whom. Now,
this is a subject to which we're going to have to return. We are hard out of time. I hate to leave people hanging, but that's the kind of analysis we will so value from you, Shoshana
Bryan.
Just watch. We'll
be
watching this space.
Iranian military action. Watch that.
Okay. And maybe Israeli as well. Shoshana, come back to us soon with updates. In the meantime, thank you and bless all the work you do at the Jewish Policy Center. Keep it
up. Thank you, Frank.
I'll talk to you soon. We'll be right back with more with John Lott right after this.
Destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say, joined, I believe, for the first time by John Lott Jr. Dr. Lott is the founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center and one of our country's leading authorities on matters involving crime and guns and the use of them in connection with crime in particular. John Lott, it's great to have you with us. Welcome, sir.
Well, thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Let me ask you first, you have two pieces reasonably recently in Town Hall magazine that I thought I would cover with you. One is the curious phenomenon that if you happen to be of the left and particularly animated by environmental concerns, you're not going to get called out for that in connection with serial gun-inflicted mass murders. Why would that be, sir?
I guess you'd have to ask the media why they do that the way they do it. But, you know, basically what happens is that when somebody is a racist, they will be described as a conservative or a right-winger. And yet you go and you read the manifestos or diaries from these mass murders, and it's pretty clear that, you know, they couldn't be further from that if possible. You know, just recently we had the sentencing for the El Paso Walmart mass murderer who had killed 23 people and wounded another 22 others. And the media, when they were describing his sentencing, was going on accurately about him being a racist. The problem is they ignored what was the basis for his racist views, and that was he feels we have too many people in the world, that having more people damages the environment, and he's particularly upset with minorities because he felt that they were having more than their share of children that they should be having. And you see this happening time after time, not just in the United States, but you have people like the New Zealand mosque murder. You have last year, the Buffalo mass murder in Buffalo, New York at the grocery store there. who have essentially identical views. These guys, the Buffalo mass murderer described himself as an eco-terrorist. I don't know, maybe you have a lot of conservative friends who call themselves eco-terrorists or call themselves socialists or upset about people having kids, but that's, I don't know, maybe I just have a very narrow set of conservative friends that I have that don't have those views.
They're generally not on the right, I don't think. But John, let me ask you, you mentioned manifestos. In my experience, one of the things that's troubling about all this is that there seems to be a pattern of those sort of documents about the thoughts that have animated people, their motivations, what have you, are not generally made available or certainly not in an expeditious way when the narrative is being set for these crimes.
Well, I mean,
and,
these manifestos are released almost immediately, almost always, except the one exception has been the Nashville school shooter.
That's one I was thinking of, yeah. Yeah.
But the other ones are either contemporaneously released or released within a day of the attack. The Nashville one is very unusual. What the problem is, it's not that these aren't released. The problem is, as you suggest, how they're covered. They're covered very selectively. So, you know, when these guys are leftists, I mean, you have the New York Times that must have run like 8 editorials over the last year talking about, you know, right-wing extremist mass murders. And the number one example that they've had has been the Buffalo mass murder, which, as I say, they classify as a right-winger, conservative, just because he's racist. But the problem with the media coverage goes well beyond just the political views of these guys. One of the things that these mass murderers frequently talk about is why they picked the target that they did. You take the Buffalo mass murderer again as an example. He goes into great detail, explaining that he picked the target that he did because of the fact that he wanted to go to a place where he didn't think his victims were going to be able to go and defend themselves. He wanted to pick a gun-free zone to go and do the attack. These guys may be crazy in some sense, but they're not stupid. Their goal is to get media coverage, and they know the more people they kill, the more media coverage that they're going to go and get.
And John, whatever their particular ideological preferences, this seems to be one of the reasons why they're attracted to schools as well, isn't
right.
it?
Well, I mean, right. You know, these guys want to get attention. And I think if they go and kill helpless young kids, I think they think that they're going to get more attention than they would have otherwise. You take the Nashville mass murder. As we mentioned, they haven't released the manifesto yet for him or her, whatever you want to call it.
Whichever pronoun which you wish to use. Yeah.
Which occurred at the end of March, which is extremely unusual. But the Nashville police chief did get to look at it. And he did mention the day of the attack that that mass murderer had actually planned on another target. That had been their first choice, but that they had decided against that and picked the school because they were concerned that that first primary target had armed security that was there. And that had dissuaded them from going and doing the attack. You would think, given how much we're concerned about stopping these attacks, you would think that the media would at least find it somewhat newsworthy once in a while to go and mention why these people picked the targets that they did. I should mention one other thing, since we've been talking about the political views. The vast majority of these mass murderers have no discernible political views. I mean, you're talking about only about 8% are racist in any way, despite the constant theme from the Biden administration that that this is a major motivating factor. And many of those, as I've just mentioned, are, in fact, most of them, I would argue, are socialists or environmentalists of one stripe or another. And but the vast majority of these individuals are simply want to commit suicide. People have always wanted to commit suicide, but at some point along the way, they realize that they could get people to notice that they had been here And so if they commit suicide by killing lots of other people, they can get lots of media attention. And you'll see in these diaries and manifestos, one statement after another, well, they'll say, if I could only kill more people than such and such did, I can get even more media attention. So I'm not...
And going into places that are not defended gives them a better shot, if I can use that expression, at getting more kills and more media attention. Right. John, you mentioned political views. One of the things that you've written about at Town Hall recently as well is seeming, well, shortcomings, to put it charitably, in the Democrats' understanding of gun violence, as they call it, gun violence, crimes committed with guns, and what can be done about them. Talk a little bit about this in connection with this business about pistol braces, for example, and some of the views that have been expressed about those.
Right. Well, before I get to that, just as a general point, you know, we constantly hear the discussion about gun violence. I don't think most people realize that a little bit less than 8% of violent crime involves guns in any way. And, you know, the way you reduce violence with guns is the same way you reduce violence generally. You have to make it risky for criminals to go and commit crimes. And the Democrats, you know, refuse to go after the prosecutors who are prosecuting violent criminals. They're not talking about the liberal judges that have released massive numbers of inmates from local jails around the country. They're not going after
and creating gun-free zones, as we talked about, you know, invites.
You know, with regard to the pistol braces, just so people understand, a pistol brace was something that was originally designed for veterans who had maybe lost part of their hand in combat or been partially paralyzed, where they found it difficult to go and hold on to a gun when they have the recoil from the gun. So a pistol brace is essentially a strap that fits around the gun and the person's arm to make it so that it's easier for them to hold on to the gun when they have the recoil that's there. And it was something that was originally approved during the Obama administration, hardly an administration that was sympathetic to gun ownership, but they realized that this was something that helped disabled people be able to go and use a gun. And, you know,
including for self-defense, right?
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. And surely disabled people tend to be more, you know, good targets for people because they are easier to deal with. But, you know, you look at the debate that occurred in the Senate, the House voted to overrule the Biden administration rule on pistol braces. The Senate,
which would ban them effectively, vote, right?
Right. The Senate, on a pure party line vote, all the Democrats voted with the Biden administration to keep this rule. But if you listen to the, you know, even senators from like John Tester from Montana, who you'd be surprised by. But the arguments that were being made by the Democratic leaders in the Senate was just hilarious. I mean, you have Durbin and Schumer, the two top-ranked Democrats in the Senate. And people can find this on our website at crimeresearch.org. We have copies of their videos of their statements.
And John,
where they were
I hate to say this, but I'm going to have to encourage them to go there because we're out of time. Thank you, sir, for your visit with us. And I hope you'll come back with updates on all of this. This is vitally important, I think, to the security of the American people, as well as our country. God bless you, your great work at the Crime Prevention Research Center. Take good care. We'll be right back with more.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Israel is in turmoil, thanks in part to a former chief of staff of its military who has recently been revealed to have plotted the overthrow of Israel's government since 2020. That's long before last year's election of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu with a popular mandate to reform his nation's judiciary, a version of which was approved by Parliament today. The seditious machinations of retired general and former Prime Minister Ehud Barak should be a warning for the U.S. Senate. It is poised to confirm a highly political general, C.Q. Brown, as the next chairman of America's Joint Chiefs of Staff. Alan West has warned that in that role, he would be, quote, Al Sharpton with 4 stars, unquote. Think a U.S. general who champions critical race theory's hatred of whites and America's systemic racism, running our military won't be a problem? Think again. RejectGeneralBrown.org. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and I'm always delighted to be able to say welcome to both you, of course, but also to our next guest, a regular here at Securing America. His name is Bill Walton. He is the host of his own television podcast program, The Bill Walton Show, Master of the Universe, now recovering, former Allied Capital poobah in Wall Street, and these days a prominent figure in the conservative movement here in Washington, D.C. and across the nation. We're always thrilled to be able to take stock with him, in a manner of speaking, about what is going on in the world of finance and business and geopolitics. And Bill, it's good to have you back for that purpose. Welcome once again.
Great, 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 Frank, to talking with an American hero, Frank Affney.
Thank you. Well, let's get that in writing, as they say. Bill, let me ask you about BRICS. There's a lot of talk about this upcoming summit in South Africa in connection with the idea that these guys, no kidding, this time they really mean it, are going to come up with an alternative to the dollar. Yeah. Exactly what that looks like and how backed up by gold it is remains to be seen. And yet, in addition to the 5 countries named in the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, BRICS acronym, there are 30 or 40 others that are banging at the door asking to be made members as well. Give us your sense of what is likely to eventuate there.
Well, the backstory here is that the U.S. dollar status as reserve currency gives us an enormous clout in the world, and people are forced to hold our debt because it is a reserve currency, which allows us to finance these enormous deficits we're seeing, both trade and currency deficits or budget deficits. But the dollar status, it's about 59% of the world's reserve currency right now. But recollect, it was 81% before in the 70s. And then when inflation started raging, it dropped all the way down into the 40% range. And then with the introduction of the euro, it faded somewhat. But still, it's roughly 60%. Euro's about 20%. Japan and Great Britain are another 5% each. And China's way down there at 3% because nobody trusts the Chinese Communist Party. And their currency is not freely convertible. But nevertheless, people want to, you know, countries are now seeing what the Biden administration has done with its currency controls on and sanctions on Russia, and they want to develop an alternative. And so they've come up with the idea, which is a good idea, to create a new currency backed by gold. And both China and Russia have been buying gold in enormous quantities in the last year, year and a half, something like that. So they are stockpiling gold. And some of the other minor countries are also doing the same thing. And so there are gold reserves that are piling up there in an effort to back this currency. Of course, you know, we have enough trouble conducting our own currency with just one country. And you begin to think about the political dynamics between Brazil and China and India and Russia and South Africa and the list goes on and on.
To say nothing of all these others. Yeah.
And so,
Bill, it's just a question, quite a meeting.
I wish I
yeah, we'd all like to be flies on the wall.
I get myself invited.
Question though, when people talk about gold backed, obviously there was a time when you could take a piece of paper, I guess, to some window somewhere and actually extract the equivalent amount of gold. That day is long past. Is there any reason to believe that a country like China that, you know, will make its currency, you know, convertible to any other currency, let alone to gold, I think, has that kind of transactional quality in mind? Or is there something else that could be equally, you know, confidence building, I guess, about the value of the currency without it being actually something you could take and go get your gold back?
Well, I could see it happening in a galaxy far, far away and millions of years from now. You know, the political and the kinetic, the real issue, of course, is we believe China is going to do something about Taiwan, and that makes them an incredibly dangerous country, and nobody's really going to trust their currency with that as a backdrop. And any country right now is going to have trouble going off the gold or going on to the gold standard. If you recollect, Richard Nixon brought us this by uncoupling from gold in 1971 at the advice of Milton Friedman. And that has been catastrophic. And we've seen a debasement of all the currencies worldwide ever since then. I talked with George.
I didn't realize that Milton Friedman, who is widely regarded as one of the great sages of economics, was responsible for that bad advice.
I guess we're all flawed, and George Gilder tells that story, and John Tamney, and I think they're absolutely correct. They're quite knowledgeable about it, but it's something we've had to live with ever since, and it's allowed us to finance these enormous deficits. And some people ask, well, is there enough gold in the world to back currencies? And there actually is, even though the size of the economies have grown enormously since the good old days of gold-backed currency. There's probably still enough if you had a meaningful way to provide an exchange to make it happen. But the issues are political, and the issues are also economic. The United States still has by far the largest free market, free economy in the world. I wouldn't include China in that category. And so you've got the biggest player that people have to reckon with, which would be us. And China is roughly the same size, but they've taken their currency out of play. And then you're left with the euro. I mean, really, European banks, you trust them? And Japan, of course, has been a deflationary spiral for 25 years now. So I hope they do it, Frank.
Yeah, I know you do. You've got this iconoclastic idea that this is actually really going to be good for us. And taking that dose of medicine is not always palatable.
Well, we've
obviously
been proliferated, Frank. We can't.
We have.
Do all
we have.
$1 trillion deficit.
But the question, no, I don't disagree. The question, though, is, will the treatment be worse than, you know, the disease itself?
True.
And that's to be determined.
True.
Bill, I do want to put in a plug on the other side of a short break about our friend and colleague Kevin Freeman's idea for what we might do to have real gold-backed currency.
Texas style.
It's Texas style. We'll be right back on that and more with Bill Waldenmuir. Stay tuned.
Welcome back.
We're visiting with Bill Walton, as we are privileged to do about this time each week. Bill, we're just tantalizing people with the idea that our friend and colleague Kevin Freeman, host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman and a regular also here at Securing America, has developed with folks in Texas, and apparently there are now 12 states altogether that are actively looking at taking advantage of apparently a constitutional opportunity to essentially mint their own currency, as long as it's gold or silver backed. They missed, at least initially, the opportunity to get that started in Texas due to some skullduggery in the Texas legislature, I believe. But there's still a possible option there with a special session. But if not there, perhaps in one of these other 11 states. You've had a chance to look at his new book, Pirate Money, which is, I think, going to be out at the 1st of August. Give us a quick book report, as well as a sense of whether this idea for gold-backed currency, for example, may really be the ticket.
Well, if you want a quick overview of the financial plight we find ourselves in, his book is a great primer to do just that. I mean, it covers everything. And unlike most of these books, I mean, there are a lot of books out there that tell us how terrible things are, and I don't know what we're supposed to do, go hide. He actually has a constructive alternative, which is to create a currency backed by gold. And my working assumption forever has been that only the federal government would allow a currency to happen. But his team's found a provision in the Constitution, and I won't bore us with the details, that they believe allows states to do something backed by gold, which is another terrific idea if they can make it happen. But there's so many forces at work to keep it from happening because, for example, the Federal Reserve Bank is working, and I think they're doing it even as we speak in August of 2023, to roll out its central bank digital currency. And the ultimate threat of that is they'd be able to monitor every single one of our expenditures and maybe decide some were okay and some weren't. So that's a threat.
That actually controlled our access to the money, perhaps.
I see all the forces at work to keep a gold-backed currency in Texas from not happening. And I think, as you pointed out to me, they got to the Texas legislature to make sure it didn't happen. But it's a good idea, and good ideas, you know, eventually things will get so stressed economically that we are going to need gold, I think, to ride into the rescue.
Yeah. And the advantage of this is that, you know, you can actually, as with a credit card, essentially tap into those gold reserves on a fractional basis. You don't have to, you know, take a coin and figure out how to exchange it for something. A fascinating idea. We'll be talking more about it, I know, with you and Kevin and others in the days to come. Bill, I did want to, before we ran out of time, just touch on the state of decoupling from China. It seems as though Xi Jinping wants to do it, and increasingly even some of the Wall Street mavens seem to be indicating that they better diversify a bit, maybe in Japan, as Larry Fink has suggested. Give us your readout on where things stand in that regard, and is decoupling, in fact, something we better get going on?
Well, it is something that's happening, but the rate at which it's happening, and you and I were laughing a bit before we did the show, which is that I think it's happening at the rate that maybe the tectonic plates of Africa separated from South America 100 million or 200 million years ago, and that we may be creating new continents, but very slowly. There are very interesting signals here. For example, Larry Fink, who's been all in on China, is now telling investors that maybe they ought to start looking at Japan, because he thinks that China, slower growth, economic growth, is going to make it less investable. And coming from Larry Fink, that's quite a statement. He's proved himself quite pragmatic on so many things, for example, ESG, and he's doing it again with China. But every country, every multinational now is looking at their data systems and deciding they need a separate IT system for China than they have for the rest of their company worldwide. And so that's beginning to happen. And on,
because the Chinese are insisting on access to their data, China-based,
right? And China's making, you know, Xi himself is making China uninvestable because he's shutting down all the due diligence firms in China, the firms that, you know, I used to rely on, or people in private equity, venture capital would rely on to find out what's really going on. Well, they're being shut down. And so if you're an investor from outside China, it's darker than ever and more dangerous than ever.
Well, and that combines with the possibility that we will be at war, the old-fashioned shooting kind of war.
The decoupling them, which makes thing, it, I mean, it, even the supply more chains dark. Are massively interconnected. And this, we're paying a big price for the push to bring them into the world economy. And it's going to require somebody very smart guiding our policy to make it happen. Unfortunately, I do not see a single person of that caliber in the Biden administration.
Oh, I don't either, or with the inclination, for that matter, let alone the capability. No, but to the extent that Xi himself is, you know, taking steps to, you know, separate us, and certainly that would be accelerated greatly if there is a war, no?
Yeah, that's a bearish signal. I mean, you know, we talk about decoupling, de-risking, doing all these D things. Well, it's not good that Xi agrees he wants to be less connected, because that means he'd be more free to go to war. And but going after Taiwan, China has as many vulnerabilities as we do in the semiconductor front. And so they've got to be doing a lot of calculation about whether it's worth it.
Well, the question is whether seizing those manufacturing capabilities in Taiwan would be worth it in terms of adding to the dominance that they have on virtually every other supply chain.
These are very sophisticated operations, and they're very delicate, and you've got all the engineering talent and all the IT talent, and it's not like seizing somebody. It's not like the Middle Ages where you could grab somebody's city surrounded by their fortress walls. This is a very different, more delicate procedure.
You know, it's an interesting question, Bill. Coercion is what the Chinese Communist Party specializes in, so I wouldn't put it past them to figure out ways.
I wouldn't either, but I'm
just smart people in Taiwan to do what they tell them to do. Bill, we're out of time. We've got to come back to you next week about now.
By the way, Frank, one quick thing. That's the way China would have ultimately take Taiwan, as they did it if they do it from inside.
Well, that's one of the options for sure. Bill Walton, thank you. We'll be back to you soon. Stay tuned for more right after this.